The Mac Observer's Mac Geek App, episode 643 for Super Bowl Sunday, February 5th, 2017.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, we answer them. You send in your tips, we share them. You send in your cool stuff found, we share that too. And yeah, we'll be doing that in about a minute and a half here, with the goal being each and every one of us learns at least four new things every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Blue Apron, where visiting blueapron.com/MGG gets you your first three meals for free, shipped for free. Very good stuff. Very cool stuff. We've been having a blast cooking some of these things together. We'll talk more about that shortly. Smile Software at smilesoftware.com/geek with Text Expander for Teams so that you can have everybody on your team communicating the same way. That we will talk about shortly here. And Eero at eero.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG gets you free overnight shipping on what thus far I have found to be the absolute best, certainly my favorite of the mesh Wi-Fi systems at the moment. And that's been true for a while. So we'll talk more about that shortly here. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing, Mr. John F. Braun?
Getting ready for the big podcast, or the big game.
The big podcast. That's right. That's right. So who's going to win today? Is it going to be you or me?
I don't care.
Oh, that's right. All right. You know what? Let's just do this. Let's get right into cool stuff found here. This is one that actually was sent to me via email by the developer, something called Wi-Fi widget. And it's pretty cool. Because what it does is it lets you see, it's an iOS app, works both on iPad and iPhone. It lets you see in your, what do we call that thing now? Notification center, sorry. Right from your lock screen, you can see which Wi-Fi network you're connected to. So, you know, you can, if you're like trying to do something in Safari, and you happen to be at the airport and you see that you're on Wi-Fi, you can swipe down and see, oh, crap, I'm on Logan Wi-Fi again. How did that happen? You can't change it from there because, of course, iOS doesn't let you change your Wi-Fi settings from anywhere other than the settings app. But you can see it, and you can even have it. You can even put your Wi-Fi password in and have it show you the password if you want to do that. And, you know, maybe you've got like friends over all the time. You want to show them your Wi-Fi password. If you don't have a guest network, you should get a guest network, by the way. But you know, it works. It's very cool. 99 cents. I've already found, you know, I test a lot of stuff. I've been testing all kinds of stuff. In fact, lately it's been the Google Wi-Fi and the Linksys Velop and the new Synology router that I talked about last week. So sometimes I truly at home don't know what Wi-Fi I'm on, and it's really handy to be able to see that without having to change apps and just be able to swipe down and see it. So very, very cool stuff. We will put a link to that in the show notes for sure. But handy little app. I like it, John. How about you? You like it? Have you checked it out?
I should try it because every now and then when I get home,
yeah,
my iOS device is stuck on the my ISP's Wi-Fi, Optimum Wi-Fi, and I have to kind of give it a little nudge.
Yeah.
Usually when things don't work as I expect because I think I'm on my network and I try to run something and
sure,
it like doesn't work or it just fails or sits there getting all confused, I'm like, oh, it's because I'm on Optimum Wi-Fi.
Because you're on the wrong one. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. I don't know why iOS isn't smart about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's how it goes. All right. So the next, it should be smart about that, by the way, before we move on to the next one, you should be able to, if you are synced with iCloud and you prioritize the Wi-Fi list on your Mac, mm-hmm, that same priority list in theory.
Oh, I do.
I know. I believe you.
Yeah. My local one is on the top of the list.
Yeah.
Even if I'm sitting next to it. I mean, I got
one
of the Eero's in the same room where I typically, you know, do my computing.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's feet away. I mean, it's like, dude, that's the strongest signal. Come on.
Yeah. All right. Alex, and I think this was in Facebook, but it may have been elsewhere, linked us to a great little page of Apple's that shows all of their current public repair extension programs. So even if your warranty is expired, there are some repair programs that Apple extends beyond that. If there's something going on, like there's, you know, the iPhone 6S program for the unexpected shutdown issues. There is the 27-inch iMac 3-terabyte hard drive replacement program. This page, one page, lists all of the publicly available repair and extension programs. There are at times, not necessarily always, but other ones that are not published and yet geniuses know about and can take advantage of too. But it's handy to be able to look and see, hey, wait, you know, am I eligible for one of these? Do I need to worry about this? Great little page to check out. So thanks, Alex, for sharing that with us. We love cool stuff found like that. Ken brings us another one. This one, Ken says, I have a spec candy shell case and a bracelet band on my 42 millimeter Apple Watch. And my other two chargers didn't work. He says, I had one charger that kept making a sound every minute because the watch kept coming on and off of it. And he said, I had another that was kind of on an angle, but my cool stuff found is the third charger I tried. It's called the Belkin Valet Charger Power Pack 6700 milliamp hour for Apple Watch and iPhone. It's $99, he says, and some people feel like that's too expensive, but he really likes it. It's got a little puck for the Apple Watch built right into it. It's essentially like a little battery pack, but and it does have a port so you could charge your iPhone simultaneously. So great for traveling. When it's really tough to plug something in on the bedstand, you know, in a hotel, but he's using it for his Apple Watch and he says he's loving it. He says he's able to get, you know, many, many days. He says my Belkin charger charged my Apple Watch 11 times before it needed a refill. So very cool stuff. I like it. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes, of course, because that's what we do. No Apple Watch yet for you, right, Sean?
No.
All right.
Yeah, maybe someday.
Yeah, of course. Back to Alex on Facebook. Alex linked us to something that actually Jeff Gamet wound up writing a how-to for at the Mac Observer. And it's a piece of command line software called DD Rescue. It is, as Alex calls it, the king of data recovery. He said, maybe Steve Gibson's SpinRite is better. I don't know, but this tool is absolutely amazing and it's free. You will need Homebrew to install it via terminal, but there is a GUI front end. It says, do you have smart or other hard drives that have failed that you can't get data off of? Even if it doesn't mount, DD Rescue will see it and likely be able to get data off of it. And Jeff did some testing with this. Very, very cool utility. Again, available totally for free. The TMO article that we put up shows exactly how to install the GUI for it, if you you know, if you want to do it that way. It's actually really not that difficult to do from the command line, but a GUI always kind of saves you from having to think about what command to type, if nothing else. So very, very cool stuff, Alex. Thank you for sending this our way. It's exciting, man.
And speaking of GUIs.
Yes.
If you'd like a GUI for Homebrew.
How could I not have thought that you would bring this up? Yes, a GUI for Homebrew.
It's called Cake Brew. So if you go to cakebrew.com, you get a nice GUI for Homebrew.
There you go.
Was something that I used Fink for the longest time, and the one reason I liked it is because they had a thing called Fink Commander, which was a GUI for Fink. But Fink is not, I don't know. I don't think they have as many packages as some of the other options. So I eventually ditched it and, you know, took your advice and moved over to Homebrew. But then I found this because I'm like, I want a GUI.
There you go. Yeah. Nothing wrong with a GUI. It's handy. Nice to be able to see what you've got installed and how that's all coming together. I still use the command line because I wind up managing Homebrew on multiple computers just from the terminal, so I don't have to go around and do stuff. But I totally, in fact, grok the benefit of a GUI, because that way I can just see what I've got and all that good stuff. Ed sends in, he says, your discussion on episode 641 about email clients you recommended, SparkMail. He said, I tried SparkMail and AirMail both, but then I switched over to a new one called EasyMail, right? Do I have this right? Yeah, EasilyDo, sorry. He says it's from EasilyDoMail.com. It has an assistant that can collect all of your travel expenses, entertainment type emails together from a single view. He says, I love it. And it is at EasilyDoMail.com. So, well worth checking out. And I think it's available for, well, let me make sure. But when I was testing this, I think I found it available for free. Yes, it is for free in the App Store for iOS. So if you're looking for yet another iOS email client to try out, that's the one. One last thing from in cool stuff found here, John, because it came up in last week's show, I believe. Yeah, it was last week's show. Robin writes, in 642, one listener was commenting about minimal resolutions offered for setting up displays. There is one very good utility that opens up a wealth of options and settings, and it's called Switch Res X. I really like this app for the additional flexibility it offers for almost any display, including the built-in one. And this is true. Switch Res X works. However, because of the system integrity protection, it won't install. So you have to turn it off, turn off SIP, then install Switch Res X, then turn it back on, as I'm told. I haven't tried installing it, but I did send it around to a few of you, and you reported that back. So so that is something to bear in mind. But if you want those options, then that's how Switch Res X will work. Pretty good stuff, huh, John?
Fantastic.
Lantastic is what I like to say. Do you remember Lantastic?
Oh, yeah.
Do you? I do.
Going back.
It's, yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Also in show 642, we talked about using various different apps for managing your grocery list in a distributed way. And then we got the most number of comments about a single issue in a week that I think we've ever gotten since the day we started Mac Geek Gab almost 12 years ago. And that is many, many, so many of you suggested that we use reminders, setting up a separate reminders list in Calendar or whatever, you know, in the reminders app really, but it's all linked to Apple calendars that's stored on their servers in iCloud. And if you do that, of course, you can share a to-do list, a reminders list, and then you put the stuff right on the reminders list. And of course, you can do it with voice control. I'm not going to say the trigger word, but you can do it with voice control there and add things. And we even had one of you suggested that it was a guy and a son go grocery shopping together. And they both start at different ends of the store. They both have their iPhones out with this shared list. And as one of them marks something off, it's synced to the other one's phone. So you get this constantly updating real-time list of what's left to buy and makes the entire shopping experience more efficient. So that I really like. Had to share that. Thank you, all of you, for how you do that. So it's pretty good. Pretty good. That's probably one of the best uses of reminders, shared reminders that I've seen. I never quite understood the shared reminders thing for at least for my workflow, but for this, it's pretty good. Any thoughts on that, John?
Oddly enough, I don't really use reminders either. It's the one item that
use reminders. I use it insanely. But I rely on it for so many things, but I don't use shared reminders is the key. So, but you don't use reminders at all, huh?
Nope.
It's, I've tried a lot of different to-do type of lists and that sort of thing. I find reminders to be the well, I mean, I use it via BusyCal because I like their UI, both on iPhone and on the Mac. In fact, if you haven't checked out BusyCal yet, it's outstanding. One of my favorite apps, I use it, again, both on the Mac and on iOS for managing not only my to-do lists, but reminders, if you call it that. But it links into all the iCloud stuff, so it's all the same list. But it's just simple reminders. I put it on. I say, on that date, I want to make sure I do that, and then it's done. And that's good to go. So,
honestly, I use Calendar for
your calendar me
about things that I should do.
You just put it as an appointment on your calendar?
Yeah, or as an all-day alert, and then I'll set... You know, for things like, paying taxes or whatever, I have a reminder saying, you got to do this in a week. Make sure you don't forget.
Right. Okay. Right.
Oh, just get a notification and it comes up.
You might want to try reminders. Because it's nice because it'll carry them forward and that sort of thing. If you don't wind up doing it on one day. And again, I find Apple's interface for reminders is okay. BusyCal's interface way better, more streamlined, much simpler, but it gets the job done, and that's sort of the point. So again, thank you to everyone who suggested using reminders for the grocery list. It's pretty good. All right, John, you got a tip from Ioannis, right?
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
It was a tip that they had found. I was just asking about this. They were saying, I saw this. It was a OS 10 Daily, which I guess they're going to have to rename their site now.
Right? It's a Mac OS Daily?
Yeah. Right? It's not OS. But it was basically an article saying, by the way, if you do a verify of your... So it's fairly recent, but if you verify your Time Machine backup, now how do you do that, you may ask. And the way you do that is if you go to the Time Machine menu and you hold down, yes, all right. So if you hold down Option, you're going to see an option that says verify backups. And if you choose that, this is new. Per the man page for TMUtil, so TMUtil is the... command line utility for TMUtil, but if you look at the man page, it says, by the way, ever since OS 10, 10.11, Time Machine will include checksums in the backup. And if you do a verify, what will happen is that it will compare what's on your disk with the checksums that were calculated on the backup, a checksum being a very basic way of making sure that data has not gotten corrupt. It, basically just add up all the values and say, okay, well, here's a checksum. And if you recalculate it on the computer and it's different, then one of them is wrong.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And the statement here. Yeah. So it says Time Machine records checksums of files copied into snapshots. Checksums are not retroactively computed for files that were copied by earlier versions of OS 10. So Time Machine does kind of, so one thing that, we stress to people, and we'll stress it again, is that making backups is good, but making sure that the backup is consistent is also important, because a corrupt backup isn't going to do you much good when you try to restore.
Right.
So this is something you may want to try. I don't know what algorithm they use to do this, but I'll see it happen sometimes. I'll see Time Machine running and I'm like, well, what are you doing? And it's like, oh, I'm verifying for you. Okay. I don't know what prompts that though.
Yeah, that's two different types of verification though, right? When Time Machine is verifying, it's doing like a verify disk on the sparse bundle. So it's making sure that the structure and the file system of your backup disk is intact or repairing it so that at the end of the process it's intact. It's very much not verifying that the data in your backup matches the data on your disk, right? So two completely different forms of verification. But what you're talking about here by using TMUtil to do checksums on stuff, that's very different. But I don't think that's using the verify backups thing. Although
the article claims that
I think they're
the
wrong.
The two are equivalent. Okay, they could be wrong.
I think they're wrong, unless that has changed very recently. But choosing verify backups from the menu options, it does not do verify checksums. At least it never has. Like, again, this may have changed, but I don't think they're wrong. It's worth checking into, man, because I really don't think that this is correct. I think it only, I think this verify checksums thing, obviously that will do it. And then you can compare it, to the files that exist, but I don't think just the option keys thing again, unless it's changed, but, up until what, maybe 6 months ago. So it's possible this changed in Sierra, but I don't think it did. So use the second half of this article, the TMUtil verify checksums path to backup thing. That will work, but you got to do it from the command line.
Mm-hmm.
Yavel. It's worth checking it into it, though. Have you done it? Have you run a verified backup from the menu to see if that has changed?
I'm going to have to look at the logs. Unfortunately, the console, they've kind of ruined everything.
Got it.
Or at least they significantly changed what you see in the console.
Yeah.
That's something we should revisit as well. You won't see backup D as the process, and it used to be that you could go into the console and look, search for backup D, and that would show you what a time machine is doing. I believe that's the process, right? Yeah, backup D, but it really doesn't anymore. You got to go through some gyrations, which we should I'll find an article about that. I actually have it in my notepad somewhere. You have to do some crazy stuff in order to see either real time or past activity with backup D.
You can see it. I mean, if you open up console, like you said, and just filter on backup D, you should be able to see what's going on with Time Machine. Or maybe it's just backup. No, it's backup D. That's right. This computer's got a problem with Time Machine. So it's not. So that's why I don't have any items in my log about it. Yay, Time Machine. All right. Terrence posted on Facebook that he was having a problem where he says, I'm having a problem with windows from the menu bar opening and then quickly closing before I can select any item from that window. For example, if I mouse up to the Safari menu bar and click on the bookmarks, the window or the menu pops open but closes right away before I can slide down and make a selection. Sometimes these windows will stick, but usually, and when he says windows, really he's talking about menus, will stick, but usually I have to click two or three times to have the menu stay open. They seem to be system-wide, or this problem seems to be system-wide, in the Finder and other applications. I've repaired permissions. I've run repair with Drive Genius. I've cleaned up everything with Onyx. Any ideas? And we had a great discussion. When I say we, in this case, you folks had it before I even ever saw the post. But it turned out that it was the double click speed of his mouse was set too quickly. So he changed the double click speed, and that solved the problem. During the kind of the troubleshooting that happened, and this is, again, this is one of the things I love about our Facebook group at MacGeekGab.com/Facebook, is you get so many people contributing, just their first gut reactions and their thoughts to this stuff. And Brent there said, try using Sierra's keyboard viewer to see if it thinks there are keys stuck down on your keyboard, because it's possible that having a key stuck down would cause, obviously, things to react differently. And if your keyboard, got gummed up somehow or something, and it thinks the option key or the shift key or whatever is stuck down, that might be affecting this. That, obviously, in this case, that wasn't Terrence's issue and wasn't the solution. But that's a great thing. But it was Alex who suggested going to system preferences, accessibility, mouse and trackpad, or just regular mouse. I don't think you need to go to accessibility. I think it's just system preferences, mouse, and then alter the double click speed there. And that wound up doing it. So pretty good stuff. I always love these discussions. Thank you for everyone. Thanks for Terrence for asking it, but thanks everyone for contributing and just being there. And if you're not there, MacGeekGab.com/Facebook, come one, come all. We welcome everybody. So it's a great little place and it's growing every day. We're adding tons of new members. So it's a fun little place to be. Any thoughts on that, John?
No,
of course not. No, never, 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 never. All right. Well, it's almost time to get into the questions, John, but I want to take a minute and speak about our sponsors, if that's okay by you.
Okay.
All right. I mentioned it in the pre-show, and Blue Apron is one of our sponsors this week. Blue Apron, and if you go to blueapron.com/MGG, then you can get 3 meals for free, including free shipping. Blue Apron is a service that sends you all the ingredients you need and a beautifully printed how-to sheet to take those ingredients and turn them into a beautiful meal on your dinner table. These meals are really, really high quality food, really fresh ingredients. They taste great and the instructions are fun. It's not that they write them funnily or anything. It's just that they're fun to go through because it makes it really easy. Like in our house, we all like to cook, but because Lisa winds up doing the cooking most often, the recipes and kind of the meals that we eat all sort of live in her head. So it's difficult for us all to really contribute in a meaningful way. I mean, we can certainly help her and obviously set the table and do all that other stuff. But in really being engaged in the process and having someone take, all right, you're going to do this part, you're going to do that part. It's just difficult. And this really makes that easy. It opens it up. The meals come to a little bit less usually than about $10 a person per plate, which is, you know, really not a whole lot different than what you'd spend if you were, you know, doing a decent meal for your family. And certainly a lot cheaper than going out to eat. And we find this as much fun as going out to eat because it becomes this family process that we all participate in together. And we're trying new stuff like we would be if we were going out to eat. So a really fun thing. You sign up for a subscription, but they make it super easy to skip weeks. So you could sign up for a subscription and really only have, like, you know, 1 week a month delivered if you want, or you could have every week a month delivered if you want. And some of these meals are just fantastic. You know, they've got an udon noodle soup with miso and soft boiled eggs. You know, that's kind of a thing that I don't know. I wouldn't think I could make. And yet you can. Crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. We've got some really yummy burgers coming this week that I want to check out for the whole family. You know, a cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. These are cool things and you can make them, and they all take, you know, like 30 minutes or less typically, start to finish. So you got to check it out. Visit blueapron.com. Go and blueapron.com/MGG, because that way you get the first 3 meals that you order for free. The shipping is free. Our huge thanks to Blue Apron at blueapron.com/MGG for sponsoring this episode. Text Expander for Teams is our next sponsor. At smilesoftware.com/geek is where you can learn all about this. Text Expander is something I've been using for years. In fact, I use it while we do this show to help build the show notes in real time, because it saves me the typing time of crafting exactly the right form that I need to put all this stuff in. I can just copy a link to the clipboard. I can hit, or I can type comma SN that, because for show notes, and boom, it just like fills it all out for me. It works great. I know I'm not going to get it wrong. I know I'm not going to make a typo because it's all part of the shortcut that's there. So this is very powerful stuff. Like I said, it's leveraging what's on the keyboard. Leveraging what's on the clipboard. It can also allow you to enter things into forms as the list goes, or as the process goes. So you can have it ask you questions, and you choose different things to put in at different times if you want. Very, very powerful stuff. Text Expander for Teams does that and shares the snippets amongst everybody on your team. So imagine that, right? Imagine all of it. Like, if you're going to be dealing with customers. I always say every business is the customer service business. So you're going to be dealing with customers. And I know how we all are. We say, okay, great. This is what we're going to say, you know, in this instance. This is what we're going to say in this instance. But then somebody tweaks it and somebody messes with it, or somebody rewrites it, but not everybody gets the rewrite. Well, now you put all that stuff into Text Expander for Teams, and everybody has it. All your team's common replies worded by your best writers. Nobody's making typos. Nobody has the old version. It's all synced, immediately accessible, searchable. And like I said before, simple abbreviations totally make it work. And they're available on all platforms, Mac, iOS, and Windows. It's coming very, very soon. Very, very soon. So you got to check this out. Go to smilesoftware.com/geek. Check out Text Expander for Teams. And our thanks to Smile for sponsoring this episode. Our third sponsor is Eero. If you go to Eero.com, you will be able to purchase what I have found to be the best mesh Wi-Fi system currently available. And I test all of them. I mean, it's crazy. My family, I think they kind of hate me. They hate me just for the number of boxes that are at my house, let alone all the things that I test. And thus far, I have not found anything that I like better than Eero. A big part of that is that they've been the one that's on the market the longest. And because of that, they have the most robust software. They know what works. They have lots of features in the software, but more importantly, they've figured out how to make it so that it works with your devices, because lots of people have all these devices. They have lots of these things in places. They've learned what works really, really well. And it really is. You can get geeky with it if you want, but it's mostly set it up and forget it. And you have now blanketed your home in mesh Wi-Fi. Brilliantly executed, works so well. This is like stuff that used to only be available in the enterprise. You hear us talk about this all the time here. And we've been trying to teach you how to set up like quasi meshes for years, because it's what we've been doing in our homes. Now you don't have to think about that. And frankly, even if you wanted to, what Eero does is better, because with Eero, the Eero devices themselves participate in the decision process of which of your access points any of your client devices are going to connect to. So as you move through the house with your iPhone, it's not just up to your iPhone to decide when to move to the next access point. The Eero helps you. It also helps decide whether you should be connected to the 2.4 gigahertz radio or the 5 gigahertz radio. It's very difficult for a client device to know which of those two it should connect to without having information from the radio itself. Eero participates in that process as well. Very, very cool stuff. Very, very easy. Their customer support is amazing. I've used it. I don't even think they knew who I was. Like, I don't think they realized I was reviewing it or anything when I first tested it. Didn't matter. They treated me. It was like they answered right away. They had all the answers. Everything was great. So you got to check this out. Go to Eero.com, and here's the special deal. If you want free overnight shipping, so yep, that means you could have an Eero as soon as tomorrow, depending on what time in the day you order and what day you order. And, you know, we all know how shipping works. Go to Eero.com, use coupon code MGG at checkout after you've chosen overnight shipping, and coupon code MGG will make your shipping free. So go check it out. Eero.com. Our huge thanks to Eero for being a sponsor of this episode. All right, John, I think it's time to let Dave ask a question, shall we? Does that work for you?
Yeah. Well, I'll allow it.
Okay.
Hey guys, this is Dave from Rhode Island. Just wanted to throw out a quick question. I'm actually talking on my brand new AirPods, which I love.
Sounds great.
Last night I was listening to the episode where you guys talked about that, and then also about, I forget the other name, but there was like a $20, $30 pair of Bluetooth things you guys talked about on episode 638. Anyways, I digress. Question is, voicemails that you get on the iPhone. I'm comparing the built-in iPhone to, I was also using Google Voice. The only feature that I like on Google Voice that I can't figure out on iPhone is my voicemail, the audio file itself, in addition to the transcription, but the audio file is obviously automatically in your Google account. I, for whatever reason, think it might be somewhat useful for myself to have archived copies of my voicemails. So is there any type of way that I could automate a workflow to back up voicemails that are left on my iPhone's voicemail and somehow automatically back those up to iCloud, Google, what have you? Doesn't matter to me where they go, but just kind of looking for an automatic solution to automatically archive all my voicemail. I know you can do AirDrop individually or email or text it to yourself, etc., but I'm looking for a way to somehow on the back end automatically archive all of them for me so I don't have to remember to do it. So that's my question. Keep challenge, what have you, and don't get caught. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Hey.
All right. Yeah. So this is a good question because there is no way to do this en masse using iOS. You could create something in workflow that, you know, saved it out to your Dropbox or whatever. But even still, you'd have to trigger that somehow and it would be one per message. You'd use the share sheet and then workflow can go and do the magic for you. But thankfully, we're not limited to just that which is included in iOS. If you use iMazing, that can pull voicemails out of your backups, which effectively is pulling them off your phone, and it pulls them off. It doesn't pull them off as MP3s. It pulls them off as .amr files, which are, as the Finder calls them, adaptive multi-rate audio files. And you could, which are totally playable, by the way, with Quick Look. So you could just leave them in that format. But if you wanted to convert them, you could always save them to the same folder and then either use something like Folder Actions or Hazel to take any AMR files it finds in that folder, convert them to MP3 and delete the AMR. Using like AF Convert from the Finder, something like that. So that's my thought on that, John. What do you think?
I think that really about covers it. I mean, you know, as stated, you could either manually, you know, do the share thing, but yes, that can get tedious.
Right. Yeah, and you would also forget some of them. You know what I mean? So
that's. Yeah. Fine. So I'm with you. I don't do a lot with workflow, but hopefully it would be able to you'd be able to figure something out.
I think iMazing is a better solution than workflow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I've used it too. Yeah. I mean, because it, you know, gives you a view into that's all of the individual audio files.
And you can just grab them all at once. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's how I do it. So if anybody else has a different idea, if we're missing something, I love it when we miss something because then we all get to learn. It makes it easy to hit the four, you know, but certainly iMazing would get it done. But workflow is fun. I you know, maybe not the best solution for this, but I love workflow. I use it all the time. We have a couple of different Slack rooms that we use for Mac Observer. And one of them is just for leads. Like if somebody has an idea or somebody reads something and was like, oh, you know, we should write a story about this or this would be interesting to look at from this angle or whatever. We have, you know, a Slack room where you can just dump that stuff. And so I've built a workflow. So if I'm reading something in my RSS reader on my iPad or whatever, I can just hit this workflow and say, share it to leads. And it goes automatically, finds the right room, puts it there. It asks me if I want to put a comment in or not. So I can comment it if it's not obvious why I'm just dropping it there, you know, that kind of thing. And again, you know, like any automation, like we were saying, even during the text expander spot, any automation really limits the opportunity for human error, which is obviously an important thing to eliminate. So It's fun stuff. I love workflow. You said do you have it, John? You don't use it much?
Yes, I have it.
Do you use it?
I think you gave it to me.
Yeah, I think it did. Yeah.
It's cool. I'll have to revisit it.
It's cool. Lucas, we were on our way. I like to. So my son, he's 15 now, but he's been quite good at math for quite some time. And it got to the point a couple of years ago where I realized, whoa, he's getting faster than me at this stuff. And part of it is because I don't use math every day like he does. So I just started doing an interesting thing where I would calculate the tip. If we were out to eat, I would calculate the tip such that the grand sum total of the, the price plus the tip came to a palindromic number, which I thought would be cool. It makes me think a little bit before I just, round and leave. And so I did that one night at the restaurant, and he had built a tip calculator or was using a tip calculator in workflow, but I think he had built it. And he said, I bet we could do the palindromic tip calculator in workflow too. And I started thinking about how I would do this. And I thought, man, I don't know. One of the limitations of workflow is it has, I believe this is still true, but certainly at the time it was true. It had no case statement. So it would be very difficult to code it in a way that, got you what you wanted and did all this stuff. It would just be the way I was thinking about it would be this series of if else loops. Right. And I mean, just like this mess of them. And I thought, yeah, man, it's possible, but that's a lot of work. So by the time we got home, he was finished and he didn't use an if else loop. He was much smarter than that. He just took the total that you plugged in, multiplied it by whatever your preferred tip percentage was, dropped the cents from the thing. So essentially made the number an integer and then took the dollars or the right two digits of the dollars, because if it's a three digit thing, if it's over $100, then, you don't want to do that. But he took the right two digits of it and swapped them and then just put those as the cents without doing any calculation whatsoever. It's yeah, that's pretty good, kiddo. So now that's what I use. I don't do math anymore. So he's totally foiled my plans. But workflow is fun. It's good stuff, I think. Yeah? Too geeky? Not geeky enough? Workflow is an iOS app for automation. We will put, I think it's workflow.is is the URL. It is. So we'll put that in the show notes too. But see, that stuff's fun, John. And workflow makes it really easy to just, bang stuff like that out. And you can share them and all that good stuff. If anybody wants that palindromic tip calculator workflow, I will happily share it. Just let me know. Feedback@mattkeekab.com.
I didn't quite hear you, Dave. I thought I heard you say feedback@mattkeekab.com.
I said feedback@mattkeekab.com, and I said it right. I'm pretty sure. That's good. Yep. Okay. Let's see. Let's go to Graham here, John, because this is fun. Graham writes, he says, I was listening to episode 641 where you were talking about speeding up an older Mac. My mid 2011 21.5-inch iMac has an i7 with an SSD and is fine right now. But I notice I'm often skimming the ceiling with its 8 gigs of RAM, so I would like to take it up to 16. Apple gives a max RAM of 16 gigs, but Crucial says it will take 32. With that in mind, Crucial can supply 16 gigs as either 4x4 or 2x8. Two 8 gig chips brings a 30 pound savings. Graham is in the UK, I would assume, over the 4x4, and also leaves two free slots for the future. My question is, are there any potential speed differences between the two options? For instance, is it better to spread the load over all four slots? Also, my current config is 4 2 gig chips. If I went for the 2 8 gig chips, could there be any slowdowns by putting two of my current 2 gig chips in the empty slots that are left, bringing my total from 16 then to 20? I'm thinking of the imbalance of differing RAM sizes here. I'd appreciate any advice. So, Graham, what you're asking, this is a great question, by the way. And what Graham is asking about, I think, John, is something that's called memory interleaving, right? Where if a computer supports it, the system can make itself a little bit more efficient when reading or writing from RAM, maybe 5 to 10% speed increase by using more than one chip. So it writes to one, and while that is refreshing, it writes to the next one, and it kind of treats the two chips as one. But because they are two separate chips, then there can be, or two separate modules, I should say, then there can be an efficiency there if it's kind of, you know, bouncing back and forth. And good news, your four RAM slot iMac does support memory interleaving. So you can benefit from this 5 to 10% speed increase. But everything that I read about this for you indicates that that iMac only interleaves two banks, two modules at a time. So there are two banks of two modules each. So as long as you have the same size chip in each of the two banks, so if your first bank would be the first two slots, if you have the same size chips there, and then the second bank is separate from that, you can have different sizes, but if they are the same, then memory interleaving turns on. So yes, you could do 2 8-gig chips in the first bank and 2 2-gig chips in the second bank. You would be taking advantage of interleaving, and you would not be slowing yourself down at all. So that's, I believe, my answer, John, but I know you've got some thoughts on this.
No, I thought I answered this question form too. When I was looking at this, I'm like, wait, you answered it? I thought I answered. I think I was thinking about an answer and then got distracted or something like that. But no, you're absolutely right with the interleaving.
So it is just two chips per interleaved bank. Is that the right way to sort of crystallize that? Is that right?
As far as I know, yes. Okay. You definitely, and as was pointed out, Apple typically doesn't. I don't know why they never tell you the maximum amount of RAM.
Well, they tell you it's just wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. you seen?
Same chip. Same chip in a pair will give you better performance. I mean, memory chips are already crazy fast anyways.
Right. Right.
Right. I mean, some of them operate, I think they're like in a gigahertz or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, my 2011 27-inch iMac here is running 1.3 gigahertz DDR3 memory modules. I mean, they call it 1333 megahertz, but you know, that's how math works. But it won't say, like, I don't see anything in here that indicates that interleaving has been enabled. I'm looking in.
Wow. So where would one, you know where I'd look, Dave? I would look in, let's look in system report under RAM and see if it, or memory.
Yeah, I don't see it there. I don't see interleaving.
Yeah, all it's saying, so it says ECC disabled, which is typical of most Apple products. Upgradable memory, no, because I'm looking at my Mini right now.
Okay.
It doesn't indicate if interleaving is in
and
place.
I definitely have interleaving enabled on this machine here because I've got 4 8-gig chips. So, you know, same principle applies, but so in theory, banks 0 and 1 should be interleaved, and then banks this is interesting. So there's bank 0, dim 0, bank 1, dim 0, bank 0, dim 1, and bank 1, dim 1. Is how it's listed here. But so it's possible. I seem to remember something about this now, John. Help me scratch my head with me, if you would. Not just because it feels nice. No. I think it'll help me think. Are the banks the two adjacent slots, or are the banks the two, like, do they skip a slot? I think it's alternate. Right. So it's bank 0, dim 0, and bank 0, dim 1. And I think those are like 1 and 3. If you were looking at if you looked at the slots and said 1, 2, 3, and 4, I think it's 1, 3, 2, and 4. We got to look into this. I'm hoping that somebody in the chat room might know about interleaving, because I know it's possible. But really, I guess the thing to do would be to put the chips in and then come here to system information and look at memory and make sure that bank 0, dim 0, and bank 0, dim 1 are the same size, but I think something I seem to remember on this machine, or at least on a machine in this room, and it might not have been this machine, but having to do it with it like the leapfrog kind of layout. So I forget. So you got to check it. Data for Nothing and Bits for Free in the chat room says alternate banks other way around. So I'm not, but I'm not sure what that means. Alternate banks, DIM zeros are the same size. DIM ones are the same size. Ah, okay. So it is the other way around. So in this, then it is, you put the adjacent chips of the same size. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Data for Nothing and Bits for Free. So it is DIM zeros are the same size and DIM ones are the same size. And you have bank zero and bank one of each. Okay. Wow. All right, John, get us geeky with networking mess with Michael.
Yeah. Well, this is I was scratching my head over this one.
Here. Okay. Well, you scratch your head. You scratch your head. I'll scratch mine. Wait.
And I'd like to get your thought on this one, because I'm speculating as to what the problem is here. But Mike says, hey, guys, I've been having an issue on my 2015 12-inch MacBook running Sierra. It takes up to 60 seconds after waking from sleep before any web content will load in the browser. After that 60 seconds or so, everything is fine. Immediately upon opening the MacBook, the Wi-Fi menu bar icon shows that I'm connected to my network, so it's not like it's taking time searching for the network. I should note that this only occurs when the computer has been sleeping for longer than about an hour. I'm using a Netgear 8500 router, if that makes any difference, and this problem doesn't seem to happen on this machine with Windows 10 via boot camp. Thanks for any help, and keep up the good work. We'll do what we can. My initial gut reaction on this, Dave, is that maybe this is a DNS issue.
I'm picking up what you're putting down. Yeah.
But my initial thought is that it's a DNS issue. Perhaps the DNS cache. And we know, you know how we all love caches, except when they get corrupt and they don't do what they should.
I love cache. Wait, that's not what you're talking about.
C-A-C-H-E, cache.
Right.
Five-letter cache. One thing you may want to try, because it's only happening on the Mac side, you may want to flush the DNS cache. How do you do that, you may ask? And there's a few ways of doing that. So one is you use our pal Onyx. And if you go to cleaning, internet, there's a little checkbox for DNS cache. So do that. There's also an article I found from dreamhost.com that tells you how to do it from the command line, but might as well use Onyx since it's free. So that's one option. Another could be you may be running into a DNS fallback situation in that typically you have more than one DNS assigned to your, typically you set it up on your router. You can set it up on the client, but I think it's a better strategy to set it up on your router. So it's the same for all of your devices. And typically you have a primary and a secondary. It could be that it's failing and maybe 60 seconds is the timeout where it's like, I'm not getting anything done here. So let me go to the fallback one. So you may actually want to set different values for the DNS or maybe change the order of them and see if that helps. While you're doing that, though, you may want to explore and find out what the best DNS is for you. A lot of times the default is what your ISP provides, but that is not necessarily the fastest or the best DNS. There's a dandy little utility that I've used in the past, and that actually convinced me to move over to OpenDNS and Google. So I use both of those because those are the two fastest that this utility found. And the utility is called Namebench, and github.com/google/namebench. So those are a couple of thoughts. I actually have more thoughts, Dave. What you could do, now you may not know this, but you will now, is that if you go into your Wi-Fi menu and you hold down the option key, as is often the case, you will see more goodies. So one thing it'll tell you is if you look at the access point you're connected to, you may want to make sure you're going to see something that says internet reachable. We just want to make sure that during that time frame where you're starting up, that it is, in fact, set to reachable and not reachable. There could be some issue with you getting to your ISP. I don't know.
Sure.
But there's also some things here, Dave. There's a, if you hold down the option key, you're going to see, if you're on wireless, you're going to see open wireless diagnostics. You may want to run that and just see what it says. That could help isolate the problem. And lastly, the thing is, if you're having a problem with a wired connection, there's also a test, but there is no Ethernet menu. So you can't go there. So if you want to test your run Apple's utility to test your connection for a wired connection, you would go to System Preferences, Network, click on Ethernet, and then you're going to see a little button that says Assist Me, dot, dot, dot. And if you click on that, you're then going to get a few options. And one of them is Diagnostics, dot, dot, dot. So if you're having a problem with your wired connection, Apple will do their best to try to figure out what the problem is. And last I've run it, I'm not going to run it now because I don't want it to disrupt my connection.
Right.
But I believe one thing that utility checks, and I think the wireless version as well, is they will check, you know, is your DNS healthy and working properly. So that's what I got to say about that.
Yeah. So I'm with you on this DNS thing. Maybe. Peter Cullen back in our Mac Geek Gab Facebook group was asking about an issue where he was having his network connection start to do this sort of randomly, not just after reboot. And the best way he could solve it was to turn off Wi-Fi and turn it back on again, which, you know, fine. But I said, well, go one step deeper. And instead of turning it on and off again, go into System Preferences, Network, Wi-Fi, Advanced, TCP/IP, and click Renew DHCP Lease to get refreshed information from the router. And he said that worked. But I believe that also will flush the DNS cache because it's getting new information. So it's saying, all right, let's start from scratch. So I think his problem is the DNS cache as well. It's possible, like I said, I'm picking up what you're putting down. It's possible that what Michael is experiencing here is a DNS issue. But the part that kind of gives me pause on that is that he said it takes, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of a minute, 60 seconds for the computer to start working on the internet. And then after that, everything is fine. So it could simply be that whatever you're doing to boot the machine or log in to the machine is, you know, slowing things down. Or it could be, so it'd be worth trying this like in safe mode with the shift key down where it doesn't load any of the stuff at startup. That would sort of rule that out. So that would be a good thing to try if heading down this DNS path doesn't work. But the other thing that it makes me think of is proxies. So System Preferences, Network, again, for Wi-Fi, you'd go to Wi-Fi. For Ethernet, you go to Ethernet. For Wi-Fi, you'd go to Advanced. For Ethernet, you don't have to. And then after you're there, go to Proxies. And it's like the sixth tab over or fourth tab, depending on which one you are. Make sure nothing is checked here unless you know that something should be checked. Really, there's a checkbox sort of separate from all the rest way down at the bottom that says use passive FTP mode. That's fine. That's fine to leave that checked. But the rest of the boxes on this page, unless your ISP has told you you must check them, do not check them. Because especially if auto proxy discovery or auto configuration is checked, it's going to be looking to get information about how it should connect to the internet. And it will sit there until it gets that information, which if you have a proxy set up, it often will just deliver it right away and it'll all sort of happen very quickly. But if you don't have a proxy, your computer will wait until it times out. And then it'll say, all right, we're just going to try it sort of the normal way and see if that works. Some connections, most connections work what I'll call the normal way, where you don't need any stated proxy to do your internet connecting for you. But some connections do require a proxy where you specifically sent funnel all your requests through a special type of computer or router that then goes and forms those and puts them on the internet. Most of us are actually using a proxy of sorts with our standard router setup. But you don't need to configure that here. That just works. You tell it it's the gateway. It sort of sees the request and it does it internally. So that's the only other thing, is it's possible that a proxy could be have been set at some point. And if it was, uncheck it. See if that works. I don't know. Just another thought.
No, that's a good one. We actually did have a question several weeks ago where that was the cause.
Mm.
Now, he asks if, I don't think it's a router issue.
It could be.
Says he has a Netgear 8500. I'm not familiar with the Netgear 8500. So I don't know if there's a firmware update or a bug in there or something that you may want to.
Sure. It's possible. I've got one of the 8500. It's a tri-band router. If you have a Netgear router, as an aside, go update your firmware right away. If you haven't done it in the last week, they had a, some kind of a breach that's solved by firmware. So if you're running a Netgear router, go literally stop listening to the show, go update the firmware and then come back. And all right, you're back. All right, good. Now we can carry.
Run, don't walk.
That's right.
Lastly, you try a different browser. I don't know if it's just see if it happens with different browsers. It could be that you need to clean up Safari or whatever information it has cached. I've actually had that solve some problems where I see the progress bar in Safari just creeping along and nothing's happening. I'm like, man. And there's a menu choice where you can basically clear out most of the cruft or use Onyx to clear out a lot of the browser related or internet type cruft that accumulates.
Yep. Yep. Cool. All right. Brian has a question. Brian asks, he said, longtime listener, first time emailer. Well, it's a pleasure, Brian. I was thinking of moving my files, my iTunes library, my photos, etc., to a NAS drive, but then was thinking maybe it could be done via cloud. What are the best / safest / affordable options for this? Okay. So I think in order to answer that question, and we'll do it sort of generally, but we'll break down the different types of data that you asked about. So for your files, any cloud storage option is going to work for you. And that includes things like iCloud Drive, right? Dropbox, box.net, right? We call it Google Drive, Amazon Drive, or, and this sort of clouds the whole thing, no pun intended, something like Synology Cloud Station, which acts a lot like Dropbox, but stores it locally, right? And I would categorize the Lima in that as well. I was going to talk about the Lima in Cool Stuff Found Today, but I'm not quite done testing it, so we'll punt that till next week. But the Lima at meetlima.com is, again, another type of private cloud, syncing thing. You run an app on your Mac, it just syncs your files, and it doesn't care what kind of files they are, it just syncs them. Some services have size limitations, but otherwise, pretty much that's it.
That's where I used Box for a while, but then found that their no pay option will not let you do files over a certain size. So I don't really use Box.
Right. Right.
OneDrive is another one I'd like to mention.
Oh, there you go. Yep.
That one's really nice because they have a iOS client and a Mac.
Yep.
So kind of all your stuff is in one place. So, thought I mentioned them. Yep. I think that covers all the cloud services. Well, there may be a couple more.
Yeah. I mean, there's Nextcloud and OwnCloud, as Andy says in the chat room at MacGeekab.com/stream, if you want to roll your own, private cloud. So, but that's for your files. Now, for your music, because you said iTunes, but I'm going to split iTunes in half and say music and then also videos. So for your music, certainly Apple Music is an option. Right. Or iTunes Match, they both in that sense do the same thing. Apple Music gets you streaming of things you don't own in addition to syncing of the things that you do. iTunes Match just gets you the latter, which is the syncing of all the things that, that you do with iCloud Music Library. So there's that. There's Amazon Music, which is a streaming service, Google Music. And then there's things like the Synology Audio Station, which is your own private cloud for music. And yes, there's an iOS app for it, and you can play music there, and it actually works great. So that's music. For videos, there are no dedicated video streaming services that let you stream, you know, from your library. Certainly if you've bought everything with iTunes, then you can get things to your iPad from Apple servers or your iPhone from Apple servers. But that's not, to me, that's not the same as saying I have this big library that I want to stream like we're doing with music. So with that, you do have to go sort of roll your own as far as I know. And that would be, you know, something like Synology's Video Station or any, or, and this now is true for music as well. You could, in theory, use one of the file syncing options that we talked about to store your music and video libraries. Again, if you have enough space available on them to do that. And then that could sync amongst your Macs. Now, that's where you got to get really careful, though, because I wouldn't point my iTunes library to something that's syncing and being changed on another computer. That fails miserably. There is something called SuperSync, though, that will do that, that kind of allows you to do that sort of thing. It's as close to the holy grail of syncing your iTunes library as we've ever seen, but it's a little bit wonky. So, you know, I don't know. I've tried it. I had high hopes for it. It always felt weird to me, but maybe you would have better luck with it. There are people that use it. So SuperSync is kind of one of those that all float out there. And then photos, you know, so again, you know, any of the file syncing options can do that, but be very careful pointing your photos library at something that's being changed elsewhere. But then, you know, there's iCloud Photo Library, there's Google Photos, there's Amazon Photos, there's Synology Photo Station. You know, all of those things that are out there to sync your photos. Flickr, right?
Flickr, yes. Yep. I mentioned that.
Yeah. You got to pay for Flickr. But if you want to sync it from your Mac. Yeah. If you want to run the Flickr uploader
sync, okay.
From your Mac, then you need to pay for it. Yeah. So, but not from iOS. So it gets interesting. But that's kind of I feel like this conversation might be revisited in the future as people sort of share their thoughts about this. But do you have any other thoughts, John, before we migrate onward?
No.
No, huh? Okay. Okay. Let's go to, I believe it's a different Michael on this one. Michael says, my wife and I both use the same computer. She has a non-admin account, which she uses regularly. Suddenly, it stopped letting her log in. When the computer restarts and you get the list of accounts, the other two accounts log in fine, an admin account and my non-admin general account. When we try to log into hers, after entering the password, the spinning gear starts but never stops spinning and nothing happens. Eventually, we have to hold the start button to stop the computer. I've tried booting from another hard drive and running Disk Utility and Drive Genius. Both report the disk as being fine. I then copied all her files, including her library, onto this other hard drive for safety. Now I'm not sure what else to try. Do you think Disk Warrior would help? I suppose I could try to delete that account and copy over her files into a new account that we create, but I'd rather fix the problem if possible. So this is interesting. I feel like this might be a permissions issue with her user account that are corrupted. Now, he did send a screenshot that indicates he's on El Capitan, which makes resolving this a little bit, or testing this at least, a little bit easier. When you repair permissions with Disk Utility on El Capitan, it only repairs the system-wide permissions, those outside of the user account. And this is why in Sierra, theoretically, we don't have permissions repair anymore because theoretically it's impossible for those permissions outside of your user account to get changed. Nothing about Disk Utility repairs the permissions inside your user account on either El Capitan or Sierra. So, and those can very easily be changed by you, the user, or anything that you run. The problem is they also took out something a little magic in Sierra that lets you do a user account permission repair. And that is the reset password utility. It's something that you need. The best way to run it is to boot into recovery mode and go to the terminal. I know this sounds weird. Type reset password, and it brings up a GUI utility from there, which is great. And then from in that, you can choose to reset user permissions. And that will reset the permissions on your user account to whatever it is you want them to be. And actually, we did. We heard back from Michael, and in fact, that solved it for him. It was a user permissions issue. The problem is, if he were on Sierra, there is not an easy way to do this. One way would be to open that account up in the Finder from another account and attempt to change the permissions there. I'm not sure if the Finder would let you change permissions on another account. It might, as you, if you were an admin, it might ask you to authenticate, and then you can just sort of reset permissions back to some defaults in if you do a get info on their user folder. That would be one way to do it. I'm not sure that would get you exactly back to where you should be, but it might get you to the point where you could log in. There is another way with the terminal, and this is this gets a little weird, but if you run Disk Utility from the terminal, it's Disk Util, D-I-S-K-U-T-I-L, and then a space, and then reset user permissions with a capital U and a capital P, but not a capital R, and then a slash, and then on that drive, and then you put the user number in, and so you'd have to get your wife's user number, which you could get by going to System Preferences, Users and Groups, Control-click on your wife's account to choose Advanced Options, and from there you will see, but please don't change her user number at the top. Hit cancel to get out of this once you get that number, and then you could run that Disk Util command. But this gets really interesting in Sierra, unless, John, you found some third-party utility that would do this. No, huh? Yeah, I know. It's a tough one.
What I am trying to find, there was, I know there was some command line thing that could repair some system level permissions. I'm trying to find an article that talks about it, even though they say technically you can't.
Right.
You kind of sort of can in a very limited scope here. I'll have to dig up, see if I can find the article that talks about that.
Okay. Yeah, there is this article at appletoolbox.com that we'll link to here. And that that does talk about how to do this in Sierra with the command line. So we'll put a link to it. It talks about how to do it in El Capitan too. But this is how to do it. And it kind of talks about all of them. So yeah, I wish there was an easier way. I feel like doesn't Yasu do this? At Yasu for Mac, yet another system utility for Mac. And I believe he's got a Sierra version of this. And if he does, yes, there is a checkbox for reset home folder permissions.
I wonder if that invokes that.
The
secret terminal command. Cool.
Yeah. But the thing is, I've gone to Yasu for Mac and I don't see. Oh, there it is. Download. Yeah. So there is. There's a Sierra version. Rewind. This is the easiest way to do it for Sierra. And so we'll put a link to Yasu in the show notes, too, because that's probably the easiest way to get this done. I think it's always easier to do it with a GUI, like we said before. So. Fun stuff. All right. Where are we here, John? We're at 114. You want to take us to Todd before we leave?
Todd has a great question.
Good.
You think?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. My Comcast router broadcasts the free/open Wi-Fi Xfinity Wi-Fi network, in addition to my own private WPA2 Wi-Fi network. I almost never use Xfinity Wi-Fi except if my own network is down briefly for some reason. My neighbor, who can see my Xfinity Wi-Fi, suggested I disable it because it's a security risk to my own network. Is that true? The quick answer is no.
So tell us why that's not a security risk. And then I have another question for you. But I agree with you that it's not
a security risk. And the final, the last part of the question is, can someone join my router's Xfinity Wi-Fi and hack into the rest of my network from there? The answer is no, because they are two separate networks.
Explain that, please.
There is no connection between the two of them.
Well, we know that there's a connection between the two of them. I mean, I'm playing devil's
radios,
advocate.
The radios.
Right.
All right. So physically, there are two different radios in the router. One for Xfinity Wi-Fi.
No, there aren't. They use the same router, same channel. If I change the channel for my internal Wi-Fi network, the Xfinity Wi-Fi channel changes. It is one set of radios used for both. You're right that they are not connected, but they are absolutely using the same.
I guess, what would we say? Logically, they're separated.
Correct. That's right.
The two networks don't have anything to do with one another.
That's right.
Except that they happen to be contained within the same device. So physically, yes, they are both inside of your router, but there is no way to get from one to the other. Well, I suppose there is if you like VPN in, if you want to do something crazy like that.
Yeah, whatever's on the Xfinity network is treated as an external connection like any other external connection. So you're right. If you have something that you could hack into from anywhere on the internet, then certainly somebody could use the Xfinity Wi-Fi connection as anywhere on the internet. But that's truly where the limitation, the wall lives. It's a virtual SSID that's created with a separate network assigned to it.
Right. What I'm trying to, and they even in their FAQ, they say as much.
Yeah.
They're like, no, they're two separate networks. They're not connected to each other at all. Yep. And that one cannot act. You'd have to intentionally set up a way to get from one to the other.
Right.
It's not like somebody can log into Xfinity Wi-Fi and just get into your network.
I've always
it's very much like a guest network. So almost every modern Wi-Fi access, and that's really what the equivalent of this is. And they actually suggest as much. They're like, you know what? Rather than letting a visitor onto your home network, let them on the Xfinity Wi-Fi instead. Mm. And they claim it won't take away from your bandwidth. Is that that it's also it's separate pipes. So if you're using the Xfinity network, in theory, it's not going to take away from the bandwidth on your connection.
So that's true and false, right? Because what it won't take away from, like if you get, let's say you get 100 megabits down and 10 megabits up from Comcast, right? The people on your Xfinity or on the Xfinity Wi-Fi network broadcast from your house, not yours, but the, will not impact that 100 down and 10 up. The bandwidth that they get, it's on a separate VLAN. It's compartmentalized out and whatever they get, they get. And that's separate from you. So if you had devices on Ethernet, you would not see any speed impact from people being connected to Xfinity Wi-Fi. However, we all know the way Wi-Fi works. And until we all have client devices that support multi-user MIMO, each radio can only speak to one device at a time. And because we already know that those are using one radio, then it is possible that someone on your Xfinity Wi-Fi network could cause you Wi-Fi slowdowns if they're doing a lot of activity on your radio. Now, I don't know how Comcast decides a priority level. They might say, okay, look, if we're getting a lot of activity from the main, the paid for network, then go ahead and deprioritize people that are on this other, you know, virtual SSID. That could happen. And certainly we've all experienced that, where you join Xfinity Wi-Fi and you get nothing. And maybe that's the reason. But it certainly could impact your Wi-Fi, not from a security standpoint, though, just from a performance standpoint.
Just because there's all the Wi-Fi. Yeah.
I
get what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, there's only the one. Well, there's two Wi-Fi radios, right? There's the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz. So, you know, there's going to be the potential for contention there, I would think. But again, I don't know how Comcast has programmed it to prioritize that.
So it's not an option currently for the router that I have. When I did set up my parents with their Aeris/Xfinity, it had the option. Said, hey, you know, you want to turn I logged in. You can either do it from the web interface to your account, or if you know the username and password to the router, you can disable it there as well.
Right. That's right.
And I saw that option there and I'm like, I'll leave it on.
Yeah.
Because I trust that they're separate, and you're kind of being, you know, you're being a good network citizen by leaving it on, because if everybody turned it off, then you wouldn't be able to access your Xfinity Wi-Fi
right.
that you're paying for, right?
Right. Yeah. If it's not causing you problems, I mean, it's certainly worth disabling. If you know it's causing you problems, then by all means, turn it off. If you are, and one scenario of that would be if for whatever reason you're choosing not to use the Wi-Fi in your Comcast router or Xfinity router, and instead are using something like an Eero or any, you know, third party router, then you almost certainly want to turn it off there, because you're probably going to have your router's radio right next to your cable modem, and having two radios right on top of each other is not always the best idea. So turning that off entirely to get the radios off would be helpful in that scenario. And it's also a good thing to turn off as a troubleshooting measure. But I agree with you, John. If you decide that it's most certainly not causing you any issues, then I'm with you. Leave it on, because it that way, you know, more people can take advantage of this sort of distributed, you know, Wi-Fi. It's not a mesh, but, you know, the public Wi-Fi. So it is good. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I'm thinking of, and I've done this in the past, though it should make the selection intelligently about what channel your radio and their radio is on. I mean, I suppose they could do something stupid and put them both on the same channel, which would be a disaster, right?
You mean if you're running a third party router or something?
Well, or theirs, you know, so they have your network and then they have their Xfinity Wi-Fi network.
But that's what I'm telling you. It's literally the same radio. So they are on the same channel. Like each radio can only be on one channel at a time. So if you can test this, like go to your parents' house and run iStumbler. If you look at all the networks that are broadcast, you'll see that Xfinity Wi-Fi is on exactly the same channel or channels if it broadcasts 5 gigahertz, because it's literally the same radio. And if you go and change the channel for your parents' Wi-Fi, you know, their internal, you know, secure Wi-Fi, you will see the radio channel for the Xfinity change right along with it. Because it's one radio. So that's how that works. It's just virtual SSIDs on the same radio or radios. So, yeah.
All righty then.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but it's fun stuff. I agree with you. I'd leave it on unless there's good reason to turn it off. And one of those reasons might be if for whatever reason your devices just seem to want to associate with you know, the Xfinity Wi-Fi, even, and you can't get it not to, then it's like, all right, you got to go. Causing problems. Got to go.
All right. Well, thank you for your wisdom, because I was operating on the information they made available without actually having much hands-on knowledge, where obviously you have hands-on knowledge because they're your ISP.
So. Yeah. My dad's ISP too. I don't run an Xfinity. The modem I have here is not a Wi-Fi gateway from them, but I've messed with it. Tried to figure out exactly that. Like, are they conflicting? No, it's the same thing. So, you know, there you go. Your own little Logan Wi-Fi that you can run from your house. Maybe that's what I'll do. Maybe I'll set up a virtual network here and name it Logan Wi-Fi just to trigger myself. So, yeah,
called free internet.
Yeah, exactly.
And people can log into it.
Join me now. I always like when people get creative with their things, like, you know, FBI surveillance van or things like that.
Yeah.
I like that. It's good. Well, we already told you how to email us, unless the one thing we didn't tell you is if you are a premium listener, in which case you can email us at premium@macgeekgab.com. Because you get priority. Premium listeners, if you want to become a premium listener, just visit MacGeekGab.com and all the details are there. We've been having great luck migrating those of you that are existing premium listeners over to our new system. New people that sign up will just automatically sign up on the new system. But expect that your account will be migrated. We, in theory, probably won't even have to tell you that we're doing it. Because we've sorted out enough of the issues. I think we've got a really solid path now. So we're sort of migrating people as your renewals are about to come up. But if you're not on the Mac Geek Gab premium plan, we'd love to have you join us. Visit us at MacGeekGab.com. If you're able to, you do get... the first thing you get is that warm, fuzzy feeling of supporting your two favorite geeks. And as a thank you, we provide you with this premium at MacGeekGab.com email address where you get priority responses. We do try to answer every email that comes in, though. We're very honest about that. But those of you that are premium, you get answered first. That's kind of how we do it. Just as a thanks, because you're helping us keep the lights on here. We really appreciate it. So that's that. You can email us. Oh, you can call us, rather. 224-888-GEEK. John, that is...
4-3-3-5.
It is. We already talked about the Facebook group. John, you want to tell them about Twitter?
What about Twitter? I love
that
Twitter.
That thing? I know.
Yeah. It's that thing. If you want to be on that thing, if you want to follow me, I am John F. Braun. If you want to follow him, he's Dave Hamilton. If you want to follow the podcast, it's Mac Geekab. You want to follow... Mac Observer, you can go there too. And and there's that Pilot Pete guy who's off piloting somewhere.
I ran into him at a hockey game recently. I told him he's got to come here, and like we got to have him. So he would love to come back. He's just been, like you said, off piloting. Somebody's got to do it. I'd like to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing us all the bandwidth that it takes to get the podcast from us to you. They've got points of presence all over the world, dozens of them, so that when you download Mac Geek Gab, you don't have to download it from me here in New Hampshire. You download it from wherever is closest to you. It's a beautiful thing, and we really appreciate that from Cashfly. CACHEFLY.com. They're a great little hosting provider and content distribution network. Also, of course, want to thank our sponsors. That means Blue Apron, blueapron.com/MGG, where you get 3 meals for free. Smile Software at smilesoftware.com/geek, or smile at smilesoftware.com/geek, where you can learn all about Text Expander for Teams. Eero.com, where coupon code MGG gets you free overnight shipping on our current favorite mesh wireless system. Of course, other sponsors in the podcast marketplace include fatcatsoftware.com/MGG, MacSales.com, Barebones.com, and GoDaddy.com, where coupon code MGG30 saves you 30%. Saves me 30%, too. I use it all the time when I'm buying new domains. I love it. It's great. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. By the time you hear this, you'll probably already know the results of the Super Bowl, but I'll say go Pats because, you know, I live in New Hampshire, and so it's just how we have to do things here. It's the rules. But I just hope it's a fun game, because otherwise then it's boring to watch. Either way. John, what do you have to say?
Well, in light of the Super Bowl, you know, I think we're going to have to change our outlook here, Dave, because I think in this case, we do want to get caught.
If you're the ball.
Yes.